middle of the North Sea, for God's sake. You know, it was dangerous. No nerves or anything. I thought this was the most natural thing in the world, talking to a microphone. I learned how not to handle my career from him.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Tony Blackburn.
I lived in a pool in Dorset with my dad was a doctor and my mother was a nurse, but she gave up nursing when she had myself and my sister. So I had a lovely upbringing, you know, in pool in Dorset, very near Sandbanks, a lovely place. So I don't have a hard luck story, you know, I've been very lucky. I had a wonderful mother and father, and I just really enjoyed my childhood very much. I mean, I didn't like going away to boarding school. I went to Millfield, and my dad went to rugby, and I tried to fail the common entrance, so I didn't have to go away from home. And I did fail the common entrance in a spectacular way. But then he found me another school to go to, Millfield, where you didn't actually have to be particularly academic to go. And I was quite good at sport, so I got a sports scholarship, a cricket scholarship, and I don't know why, because I wasn't terrific at it. It was okay, I wasn't unhappy or anything, but I just wasn't interested. I just really wanted to get my examinations and be able to leave and go into a profession I wanted to go into, and I wanted really to be a singer. And so I wanted to leave school because I was bored with it, and I wanted to get into show business because that's what I really wanted to do. I left after about 3 years. I just got out of school and I was fed up with it, really. Later on in life, I was chatting to my dad and I said to him, you know, I really didn't want to go away to school. And he said, we didn't want you to go, but I thought I was doing the best for you. I wish I'd just said to him, you know, I don't really want to go away to school. They didn't want me to go away to school and I didn't want to go away.
What sort of thing would you like to tackle next?
Well,
I want you to get the feel of investigative reporting, to learn to root out the hidden reasons and facts.
Teacher's pet. I want to be teacher's pet.
We used to go and see a lot of the Doris Day films and things like that. You know, I mean, in those days, the films were nice. They weren't as violent as they are now. And it was, a wonderful time to be brought up, you know, in the late 50s and the 60s and things like that. You know, I've been lucky right from the word go, really, to have a wonderful family life, you know, and absolutely tremendous. And I couldn't have had a better upbringing, really. Well, there was only the BBC to listen to, and it wasn't, I didn't think, the best, you know. I mean, there's the main thing was Radio Luxembourg in the evening, which was fading in and out. But that was the thing I enjoyed more than anything else. But, I mean, I liked some of the comedy programmes on the BBC. You know, the BBC is very good at talking rubbish. It always has been. They do very good comedy shows. But they didn't really cater for youngsters in those days. You know, it was all Northern Dance Orchestra and all that sort of stuff. Because of needle time restrictions and this sort of thing. There was only 3/4 of an hour of pop music every day. I had to really listen to Radio Luxembourg to hear what I wanted to hear, and I particularly liked the American music and soul music from America in those days, like the Drifters and things like that.
The Applejacks with Tell Me When, the boys and girl who up until recently were students in Birmingham. Well, they've now made enough money to take over the school.
I always liked Pete Murray. You know, he was a great disc jockey, I thought, Pete. And it was a great thrill to meet him eventually, you know, when I joined the BBC. Pete Murray was my favourite. Alan Freeman I used to like very much. And I've never modelled myself on anybody, but I think probably Pete Murray. He used to tell some, and people don't remember it, some really bad jokes. He had my sense of humour. Although he doesn't like it when I say that, because he doesn't particularly want to be associated with the rubbish that I turn out. I went to Bournemouth College. It was a college then, not a university as it is now. I went there to study accountancy, actually. I took a diploma in business studies, which I actually got. I've got an HND, a High National Diploma in Business Studies. I didn't particularly want to do anything to do with business, but my whole family were in a firm called Twinlot Loose Leaf Binders. They were in the... my grandfather was managing director there, and all the family apart from me really went into that. But I couldn't have think anything worse to go into. You know, I found the whole idea of that quite boring. And I just really always, from the word go, wanted to go into singing and, you know, the radio and stuff like that. No, I've never done a normal job. I went from college where I passed my HND, but I was, at the same time when I was at college, I was singing with a dance band in Bournemouth, Jan Ralphini in the orchestra at the Bournemouth Pavilion. ballrooms. And I was a guitarist there and singer. It was a big 15-piece orchestra. And so I did all the foxtrots and the quick steps and things like that. I used to come out with, there were about four of us, I think it was. One of them was Zoot Money. So I used to come out when the band was having their break and we used to do all the rock and roll stuff. So it was very good training, you know, for eventually doing Radio 1 road shows and things like that, because I did a lot of live stuff before I went into radio.
In the midst of all my darkness, baby, you came along to guide me.
But I used to go once a week to have singing tuition at the Berman School of Singing. I used to go up on the train every Saturday, and then I always used to sing The Night Has a Thousand Eyes for some reason. That's the only thing I ever used to sing up there. Because I thought by probably training to be a singer I'd become a little bit better, but it didn't work out that way.
Girl, there's more than enough to last the whole night.
I mean, I love the idea of DJing. I did like the idea of DJing, but basically I wanted to, I eventually used the DJing to try and get into singing, but it worked the other way around, really. And I found that when I was DJing, I much preferred that to singing. I got offered a job with the Johnny Howard Orchestra at the same time as I was offered a job at Radio Caroline. So I took the job at Radio Caroline because I thought it was it sounded more interesting, really. I saw a programme about Radio Caroline because we couldn't hear it in Poole. The signal wasn't strong enough. I saw a documentary about it, I think it was, on ITV.
For the past 6 weeks, a pirate radio ship has been transmitting pop music for 12 hours each day to the southeast of England. At 6 o'clock this morning, a second ship came on the air. The pirate ships are causing the Postmaster General a lot of trouble.
But I thought, God, that sounds really interesting, and it had only just started, you know. And then there was an advertisement in New Musical Express wanting DJs for Radio Caroline, so I applied for it, and I got a reply back. I had to introduce four records, and I think I introduced four Beatles records or something like that, and I sent it off on a tape to Radio Caroline. And as soon as I posted it in a little place called Lilliput where I lived, as soon as it left my hand, I sort of knew I'd got the job. I don't know why. There was something, I thought, I've got this job. So I got a letter back about a week later from Radio Caroline saying, would I go up to 6 Chesterfield Gardens? Then I got another letter back saying that they weren't able to hear it. And so could I submit another tape again? But I had an appointment to Radio Caroline, so I thought, I'm going to ignore the second letter. So I just went up there. I did an audition up there. The guy said, you know, if you could go and come back in a couple of hours, we'll let you know when we've heard it. And I felt like saying, there's no point really, because you're going to give me the job. And I just knew that I got that job. And it was, I think, on a Thursday, I think it was. And he said, could you start on Saturday? And I said, well, I can't on Saturday because I've got to give the job up at, you know, with the band. It's only fair. But I started on, I think it was the Monday or something like that. Because it took a long time. I used to go to all the Larry Parnes stage shows in London to the Odeon there and watch all the performers, people like Marty Wilde and Cliff Richard and people. And I thought, that's what I really want to be doing. And it was very frustrating. I got very frustrated because, you know, I thought, how the hell do I get into this? The only thing I came close to, I did an audition for Decca Records. I went up to London and I got turned down because they said I was too much like Cliff Richard. I remember going out the first day, you know, I went out to, I think it was Liverpool Street Station, and then we went to Harwich. We went onto a little tender boat through customs. 21 years old, yeah. I remember seeing Radio Caroline for the very first time, the Mi Amigo, and it was such a little boat. And I thought, how great to be a part of this, because it's giving the government so much trouble. And I thought it was fantastic. And I remember, you know, the very first day going in there and just tremendous. It was, you know, when you're young, you just, I thought this was such a big adventure. And I remember, you know, going in front of the microphone for the first time. It was a programme called The Big Lineup. It was at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Somebody else put your records on at that time. We weren't self-operating then. I think it was a guy called Doug, can't remember his name now. Very nice guy, Canadian, who put the records on for me. Because as the DJs used to put records on for themselves, the other side of the glass. And I remember sitting in front of the microphone and I thought, this is the most wonderful thing of all. I felt so at home. No nerves or anything. I thought this was the most natural thing in the world, talking to a microphone.
And you'll hear the best around like this one. The number 16 sound from Graham Bonney, Fabric of Paul Supergirl, 22 minutes past 7.
I just found it totally natural. You know, I'd listened to a lot of DJing, and I thought, I don't know. I really don't know. I just thought I'd be myself, and I loved it, and I was very enthusiastic about it. This was a big opportunity to do it. Ronan O'Reilly hired me as a disc jockey, and Alan Crawford hired me as a singer. Now, a lot of people think that Ronan O'Reilly invented pirate ships, but he didn't. It was actually Alan Crawford. Alan Crawford met Ronan O'Reilly in a pub. Ronan O'Reilly's parents, they had places in Ireland where they fitted out ships and everything. Alan Crawford, very stupidly, I think, told him that what he was going to do. Ronan O'Reilly said, well, bring your ship round and we'll fit it up for you. In the meantime, Ronan O'Reilly got a ship of his own and fitted his ship up and got it out first. But it was actually Alan Crawford who was the person who really bought pirate radio, and he doesn't get the credit he deserves. But I was hired by Ronan, and when the power, they eventually linked up. And sometimes Alan Crawford was more in charge, and he tended to sack all the disc jockeys that Ronan O'Reilly had hired. Of course, I was all right, because I was hired by both of them. And that was the only reason I survived, I think.
They should re-release that one again at Christmas, shouldn't they? A Little Eva with Let's Turkey Trot. The time on Radio Caroline, Britain's first commercial radio station, 14 minutes to 6. Tony Blackburn here with All Systems Go, and don't forget
it was lovely. I mean, it was nothing like The Boat That Rocked, you know, that film, that awful film, I thought. It was nothing like that. If it had been like that, we'd all still be out there. There were no parties, there were no girls on board. We were allowed a couple of bottles of beer or something, or lager a day, and people who wanted to smoke, they were given 200 cigarettes and things. I didn't smoke, but because, I mean, if you saw The Boat That Rocked, I mean, everybody was, according to that, on drugs and beer and stuff like that, and all parties. We were in the middle of the North Sea, for God's sake. You know, it was dangerous. You couldn't have people wandering around drunk. It was a very serious attempt to get rid of the BBC monopoly. And, you know, I'm very proud to have been a part of that. I didn't like the film, The Boat That Rocked, because it made us out to be all a load of idiots out there, and, you know, and there was no purpose. But we were all very aware that it was a very important part of broadcasting history.
You see, that's the whole point of being the government. If you don't like something, you simply make up a new law that makes it illegal.
On one occasion, I had a load of records, and I had a red sports, a little midget car. And I remember saying, if you spot me going, because nobody knew what I looked like, if you spot me in this car, just wave me down and I'll give you a record. And it took me, it was a good hour and a half to get out of Frinton, I think it was, or Harwich. The whole road was lined with people. You know, I ran out of records after about 10 minutes. And also we did a thing called the Caroline Cash Casino, which was enormous. And they had to send in, I forget what it was now, but we had stack loads of mail. I mean, you couldn't get into the building. It was enormous. I knew right from the word go there were, you know, thousands of people listening. It was a big, big, big thing.
Let's play Caroline Cash Casino. Presented by these quality products. Libby's canned food products, Nabisco shredded wheat, VP wines, Findus frozen foods.
I was doing the breakfast show on Radio Caroline, and there was a sea mist that morning. And we'd had rumours that there was going to be another ship coming from America. And Radio Caroline, the Mi Amigo, was a very small little boat, actually. Very small. I remember I was doing the show, and it was the sea mist cleared, and there was this massive American minesweeper called the MV Galaxy. And it was about three times the size of the Mi Amigo. And I remember hearing the test transmissions and these wonderful jingles.
Wonderful Big L.
Stand by now for a special announcement. Radio London will discontinue broadcasting at 2 p.m. today for final adjustments on the transmitter. Regular broadcasting will continue tomorrow morning at 6 a.m.
Because the Radio Caroline jingles were awful. I mean, they were all made in this country. They were very amateurish to sound. And I just fell in love with these jingles, you know, Wonderful Radio London. They were American Pam's jingles. I thought they were fantastic. Radio London. And I heard the first week or 2 weeks of broadcasting with Kenny Everett and all the rest of it, and Dave Cash.
The weather word around the country says the southern half of the country will have sunny spells with only a few scattered light showers.
Oh, yes. Further north... Sorry, I was going off to sleep in the corner there. Further north, there will also
be... And the American Top 40 format. And I'd been to America to hear the American radio, and I sat in a hotel room for, you know, a weekend listening to it. And I went to WABC in New York and heard Dan Ingram and Cousin Brucey and all these people.
Hi, everybody all over America. This is your Cousin Brucey. It's the WABC party. Go, go! Woo! Don't you wanna... Sing. God, you're doing fine. I hear you. What are you? With Cousin Brucey.
And I thought, this is the radio that we should have in Great Britain. And when I heard Radio London, Big L, I thought, God, I want to be a part of that. Because it was better than Radio Caroline. Everybody remembers Radio Caroline. You know, that was the one that was the first, but the best ship was actually Big L Radio London. And that's what all modern day radio is modelled on, not Radio Caroline. So Big L was there, and there was a guy called Tony Windsor who was the Hello, the TW show. And I used to listen to him, and I thought he was marvellous.
You're on the TW show. It's 9:30 past three.
Big L!
And it's revived 45 times.
And he was the head disc jockey there.
The late, great Mr. Nat King Cole.
The tender boat used to service both ships. So it first of all went to Radio Caroline, the Mi Amigo, then it went to Radio London. I was on the ship, and we were by the side of the MV Galaxy, Big L. I suddenly heard this voice, hello.
Hello.
And I looked up, and it was Tony Windsor. And he said to me, if you'd like to join Radio London, because I was about to, he said, we'd be quite happy to have you. So I said, I'd like that very much. So I went into Radio London into 7 Curzon Street that week, and Tony was there. They wanted me to change my name to Mark Roman and be a part of the Roman Empire. And I said to Tony Windsor, I'm sorry, I really don't want to change my name. My name is Tony Blackburn. And I said, it's silly because I've been broadcasting on Radio Caroline for 2 years. And I suddenly come to you and change my name to Mark Roman. I said, won't people know it's me? I said, well, yes, but he said, that's an American way of doing it. You change your name. But so I said, well, I don't want to do that. So I went back to Radio. I hadn't left Radio Caroline. I continued on there. And about a month later, Tony said, all right, you know, come and join us under your own name, which I did. I just gave him my notice, and that was simple as that, really, and said I was going there, and I didn't have a contract with them, so they just had to accept it. But it was the best move I ever made, you know, because that's where I learnt really the use of jingles and things like that. And I remember going on Radio London for the first time and going to the studio and just playing these wonderful jingles to myself, and it was fantastic.
It's smooth sailing with the highly successful sound of wonderful
Kenny was on board, and you know, it was a great place to be. More professional. Yeah, it was a more professional operation. The whole thing was more professional. That's the way I liked it. You know, I preferred it to Radio Caroline. I mean, I'll always be grateful to Radio Caroline for giving me the start. You know, I've got so much to thank it for. But where I learnt really the art of DJing in the Top 40 format, and the format of the half an hour's broadcasting, which, you know, you make up your own chart, and then it goes 1 to 10, 11 to 40, climber, revive, 45, old record, 1 to 10, American hit. And that's what it's based around. And all my broadcasting, because I program a lot of all my own programs now, apart from, all of them actually comes in. And that's what I base it on. And since I've taken over the sounds of the 60s with Phil Swern, I've changed the format of it. And I've said to Phil, I don't want to play records that are too unfamiliar. So the sound of the 60s now is much more familiar, and you should never be more than one record away from a familiar song. That's always been my philosophy, and it's the Radio London philosophy. So throughout my career, I've bought my Radio London training and the programming of Radio London and the American format to British radio more.
The Radio London Album of the Week this week is a knockout album from Nancy Sinatra called Sugar. That's the Radio London Album of the Week. And of course, you'll be able to hear the disc of the week a little bit later on, around about 5 minutes to two or so. And we'll be giving away, let me see, we've got another 10 records, Radio London Club Disc of the Week to give away. If you just joined us, welcome along to the Fab 40 Show. Tony Blackburn here with you right the way through until 2 o'clock.
And they allowed you to be yourself. It's personality radio. When I did the breakfast show, it was so terribly popular. The commercials, and we used to read commercials in those days. I mean, I could only play probably 2 records in a half hour or 3 records in a half hour because there were so many commercials on there.
Hey, everybody. It's shoe sale time at Ravel from January the 3rd. Greatest range of season's best mod footwear in town. Big, big price reduction.
It was a matter of selling. I mean, what Radio London taught us to do was to sell the product, sell what we're doing, and that's what I've always done, you know, self-promotion to a ridiculous extent. You know, we got 12 Tony Blackburn minutes past the hour. But what I've always been taught and I've always gone by is that you always put the station that you're on first, because if the station is popular, then you're popular with it. If the station you're on is not doing well, you're not going to do well on it. And a lot of radio stations don't understand that still. I always felt when with Capital Radio, when I was at Capital Radio, particularly Capital FM, they Chris Tarrant Breakfast Show was the only thing they ever promoted. And once Chris Tarrant left, it was a problem for them. You're never bigger than the station you're on. So if you take Radio 2, Radio 2 is bigger than anybody on it. And that's the way it should be.
We've never received any complaints from anybody about interfering with any frequency.
No, no.
We pay our fees.
Yes.
We, as far as we know, we have not interfered with anybody.
Never. There's room for 101 stations. There should be commercial radio in this country.
I don't think we ever worried about being shut down. I mean, they made it difficult for us sometimes when we came ashore and it would take forever coming through customs occasionally. They tried to make it difficult because we were officially going out of the country every time to go to Holland, but we never got there. And so we would come back and we'd go through customs. We had a link up with the shore by somebody, I won't mention his name because he was in the police force, but he had a little walkie-talkie and we could communicate with him every evening I think it was 7 o'clock. He was on the seafront in Frinton, and anything we needed, he'd make sure it came out on the tender boat. So the tender boat came out every day with new records on and things like that. When eventually the Marine Offences Bill went through, I thought, you know, that's quite nice. You know, we'd done all we had to do there. And it was time to come ashore.
Come on, it's time for you to get out of bed. You've got to get to work. It's getting a little bit late. Come on, up you get, out of bed.
I met Tony Windsor once again. You know, he knew the biggest agent in the country, Harold Davison. He told me that Harold Davison was very interested in representing me as a disc jockey. And he was the biggest agent in the country. He handled Frank Sinatra and all the big names, you know. And so I met Harold. And he said to me, this was while I was still out at Radio London, he said, I listened into your programme, and he said, they're going to be closed down very shortly. And he said, I'd love to represent you. He said, the BBC, I think, are very interested in taking you for a new station that I happen to know is going to happen. And he said, in the meantime, I could get you on Radio Luxembourg, if you like. And I said, well, I would really rather stay on the pirate ships. Because I said, I don't think Radio Luxembourg is really for me. You know, I just preferred the fun of being out on the pirate ships. He said, keep in touch with me. He said, every time you come ashore, keep in touch, and I'll tell you when to come off. He said, the thing to do is to come off before the rush. But I'd already been offered a job, actually, at the BBC by a guy called Teddy Warwick at a Decca record reception, and he appeared from behind a pillar and said, if you were ever thinking of coming to the old light programme, he said, we'd like to have you. And I said, that's very kind of you, thank you. I said, but I really am enjoying being out in the North Sea. And it didn't feel right. So then the Marine Offences Bill was quite close, and I came off one day and Harold said, come off now. Following week, I went to meet people at Radio 1, Derek Chinnery, who was the first controller, and Mark White, actually, it was Mark White. And I put a suit on and went in there. I remember calling him Sir. But he was very, very, very nice. They tried me out on the old light programme, doing a thing called Midday Spin. And I remember going in the first day, and Peter Jones it was. He was a very nice guy. He was the first producer there. I went in to do the show, and he said, can I see your script? And I said, oh, God, I haven't got a script. And he said, what do you mean you haven't got a script? I said, well, I ad-lib everything. And he said, oh. He said, well, we always have people with scripts. He said, well, he said, fine, fair enough then. He said, well, do you mind if we do tops and tails, they call them. You know, you introduce a record, then you come out of it. Completely pointless. But he said, come in, you know, an hour before the program, because otherwise we have to cancel the coffee and donuts. And I thought, I really am at the BBC now. We always joked out on the pirate ships that there would be a dear old lady sitting, knitting a jumper. And on my first program, she was actually there. She was a dear old thing. And her job was to open up the microphone, because it wasn't self-op. And I remember she finished off a sleeve of a jumper during my program, Midday Spin.
Some lovely little children on this one as well. I think it's going to be a very, very big hit. And if you want a time check, better give you a time check, shouldn't I? 17 and a half minutes to 1 o'clock.
Count the days into years.
The first thing I was asked when I joined the BBC, which school did you go to? When I said Millfield, it seemed to all fit into place. You know, I was the acceptable face of broadcasting. You know, it wasn't too, you know, I spoke Queen's English in those days. And so I was quite accepted by everybody there. And that was my introduction to the BBC, and I loved it. It was very quaint and lovely. So I remember walking up to the building and thinking, God, it's so big. You know, how can there be so many people working here? Radio 1 was actually where Radio London is now, in that building. It was called Egerton House in those days. I remember meeting Derek Chinnery for the first time, and they made me feel really welcome. And they didn't say, you're going to do it this way. And Johnny Beerling was there, and... they were very good. They said, you know, what do you need to recreate this sound? So Kenny and I particularly, we said, well, so a self-op studio. And they said, well, show us what you want and we'll make sure it's done for you. So it wasn't, you know, we've done it this way forever. You're going to do it the way we like to do it. It wasn't like that at all. You know, we want to put on this pop station. We've hired you. And they hired most people from Radio London, actually. And not Radio Caroline, they went to Radio London. And Johnny Beerling had already been out on the ship, actually. He came out to see us out on the ship. It was all terrific, you know, and I thought they did it absolutely well. They didn't want to stifle what we were doing, they wanted us to do it.
Because most of what Radio 1 and 2 are going to do will be live, it's not possible to rehearse and evaluate everything beforehand. And like a new pair of shoes, we shall be breaking the networks in until they fit properly.
I don't remember a lot of preparation for it. You know, we had the Radio London jingles, and instead of saying wonderful Big L, it was wonderful Radio 1. But I don't remember a lot of preparation for it. I guess there must have been, but I remember more than anything else going in and doing the first broadcast at Radio 1. You know, it was very exciting. You know, here was the national radio station. I was aware how big this was going to be.
Just for fun. Music. Too much.
And good morning, everyone. Welcome to the exciting new sound of Radio 1.
I think I was at Johnny Beerling's house, because he was the first producer I have, and he said, oh, come round to my house so that we make sure that you get there on time. I said, I'm always on time for everything, but I've got an idea. I was staying with Johnny Beerling. And we went in to do the show, and, you know, it all went pretty well. We recorded the opening for television the night before, funnily enough, with Robin Scott, who was the first... Everybody wonders who the... When they see the opening of it, there was a guy standing behind a thing, not moving very much. And that was Robin Scott, who was the first controller of Radio 1 and 2. And a lovely man. He was really, really, really nice. They made all of us feel very, very welcome. Pete Murray particularly, he showed me around the BBC. Well, I think one or two of them were worried about the fact us as youngsters were going to come in and take their jobs. And I remember saying to Pete, I said, it's not going to happen like that. And the BBC did it very well. They kept the DJs. They still got, like, David Jacobs and people like that, because they were very good. So they had the younger people and the older people as well. Pete was still there, and, you know, so we all fitted in very well.
Excerpt from a teenage opera, and that, of course, comes from Keith West. Radio 1 time now, 9 1/4 minutes past 8 o'clock, and I was hoping that perhaps Pete Murray might turn up this morning, but we haven't got Pete Murray, we've got Simon Dee. Oh, no.
I know. Imagine that.
What on earth are you doing at this time of the morning?
Well, I thought I'd come and say what a fantastic job you're doing, Tony. I'd like to say what a fantastic job you're doing.
Thank you very much, Simon. It's a bit hectic. We've got everybody.
Simon Dee was lovely. I mean, I met him, first of all, on Radio Caroline. Unfortunately, when he joined the BBC... And he had D-Time, and he had enormous success on D-Time. It was a great show, and he was very good on it. And I went on D-Time to sing a song, because I started making records then. And I went on his show. I remember the floor manager was there warming up the audience, and he said, and here's the star of our show, Simon D. And Simon D. came out and said, right, tickets are really difficult to get for this show. When I say something funny, laugh. And he clicked his hands like that and he said, give me a camera. And I thought, oh, no, that's not the way to do things. I, funnily enough, met him in Regent Street. He was having a coffee, and I joined him. I said, hello, Simon. And I'd been on the show, his show. And he said, oh, sit down and have a coffee. And we got chatting. And I said, Simon, I said, I've known you for a long time. And I said, why is it you're actually quite rude to the audience and cameramen and people like that? And he said, well, I'm Simon D. And I said, yes, but surely if you're nice to people, you'll get the best from them. And he couldn't say it. When he joined Radio 2, he couldn't be bothered to put the music together. And it all went to his head, which was a shame, you know. And he talked himself out of a job, really. I remember being in the bar, and there was Bill Cotton Jr., who was the head of everything that lived and breathed in those days. And I remember they were treating him like God, you know. And I thought, I don't think you should do that. And his agent was treating him like that. Now, Harold Davison always said to me, he said, if there's any problem, you know, you come to me and I'll sort it out. You're the nice guy, I'm the bastard. But Simon D's agent wasn't like that, and he seemed to treat him, you know. Harold said to me, he said, always keep your feet firmly on the ground. When you're at the top, it's tough to stay there, and always, you know, try and be nice to people. And I've always remembered that, and I've never wanted to be particularly unpleasant to people anyway. It's never gone to my head, because you can be there one day and you can be out of a job the next day. You know, it's a tough business. But Simon D was a tragic case, and I learnt how not to handle my career from him. That's the honest truth. It's a shame.
And now, here is your host, Simon D.
To go on in the morning and have an audience of 20 million, which we had in those days. I mean, not because I was fantastic, it was just because there was nothing else. It was a monopoly, because with the pirate ships, we tried to break the BBC monopoly. What we did in the early days was create another monopoly, actually, with Radio 1, until commercial radio eventually came along, which took quite a long time. And to be a part of a monopoly like Radio 1, I tell you something, it's terrific. It's marvellous knowing that you're going on the air and there's no opposition there, and you've got 20 million people listening to you. On the other hand, it's quite nice to go on, and if you still get an audience, to know that they're listening to you for the right reasons. The DJs, the original DJs on Radio 1, were as big as the actual acts we were playing, you know.
The best music on the best station. The time is exactly 2:30. The dateline is Wednesday, the 22nd of March.
Radio 1. I was really working really hard. I was doing Radio 1 in the morning. I was also doing programmes on Radio Luxembourg, and I had my own TV show on down at Southern Television as well, called Time for Blackburn, which for a time went around the whole country. And I was also doing discos and things like that. I've only ever missed one disco, it was, and I remember, where was I? Kensington. I had a little flat in Kensington, which I was renting. And I remember getting a phone call and saying, you know, where are you? It was somebody called Mary Titmus, who was a... She was Harold Davison's sister. I said, what do you mean? And I was actually on the floor. I'd collapsed with exhaustion. There was one week when I only actually was able to sleep for, I think it was 11 hours, 11 and 12 hours, because I was just going from one thing to another. It was, but I was young, I could take it, but it was too much, a little bit too much. And I was also singing on the show that I was doing, the television show as well. And so I had to learn the words. And one day I turned up to do the show, and I just couldn't remember the words anymore, so it was too much. So we cut back a little bit on it. You know, I didn't do quite so many discos and things like that. Harold said to me, take all this work while it's there, because it won't always be there. Well, that was 53 years ago, and now I'm exhausted.
London's Caxton Hall Registry Office. Fans and press cameraman turn out to see disc jockey Tony Blackburn get married. 28-year-old Tony had planned a quiet wedding. 500 fans and well-wishers thought otherwise.
I mean, I suppose the big failure I had was my first marriage. You know, it only lasted about 3 years, but I had a nice, lovely son from it, which is great. And, you know, we're just great, very close still. I just let it spill out into, you know, onto my broadcasting. My daddy was a doctor. I was all uptight, and he gave me Valium to calm me down a bit. And I started taking too much of it, so I was so laid back. I remember coming out of one show nearly getting knocked over. You know, I was in a world of my own. I was taking too much of it, and I didn't realise you'd get addicted to it. You know, I was very sad about the breakup of my marriage, and I did try to get her back again, but it didn't work. And I was talking about it on air, because I've always talked about my private life on air a little bit. I think that's quite a natural thing for me to do. But I bored the whole nation stupid for a long time. But somebody at Radio 1 should have told me to stop doing it. And I wasn't very well advised on that. Derek Chinnery, I thought, was a very good controller. But I'm surprised you didn't tell me to shut up. And I wish you had done. And then Phil Swern bought a record out by R&J Stone called We've Thrown It All Away. And God, I was playing that over and over again. It made it even worse. People who say that being successful and people knowing who you are, it's awful, and people coming up and asking for autographs, it's fabulous. And you go to restaurants, you get the best of everything. Everybody's, you know, treats you like something you're not. You know, it's an ordinary person, but it's great. I loved it. I've never been a real show business person, so I didn't really, while everybody else was going out to parties, I was tending to work still. I've always been a workaholic. I love working. Radio 1 was different to the pirate ships. On the pirate ships, we were all very close to one another. We knew one another. Whereas Radio 1, you did your programme and then you went on somewhere else. So it wasn't a family atmosphere there. I mean, Kenny and I, we had a strange relationship whereby we read early on, when I was out on the pirate ships, we read in one of the music papers, we didn't like one another. And for some reason, Kenny thought that was true. He thought I didn't like him. So we had the same agent, Jo Gannett, and she had a 60th birthday party. And I was married to my present wife, Debbie. And Kenny loved Debbie very much, and they got on really well together. And we were at this party, and he was wearing a white jacket, and he was drinking red wine. And I was sitting next to Kenny, and he spilt this wine, and it all went over him. And he said, "You did that, didn't you?" I said, "No, actually, I didn't." I said, "I think you spilt it yourself. You knocked your hand against it." And Debbie, who was sitting opposite, said, "That's right, Kenny, he didn't, you know." So he turned to me and said, "You've never liked me, have you?" I said, "Of course I have." And he said, "Really?" And he gave me a big kiss. And from that moment on, we were great friends. And about 2 years later, he died. But we were great friends, and it was so stupid, you know, for all that time. Because we obviously lived a different lifestyle, because we all knew on the ships that he was gay. But in those days, it wasn't, you know, he had to keep it quiet. It was stupid. But that was it. And he lived a different sort of life. You know, I'm not gay, and he thought that I had something against him, I think. And, of course, I didn't, you know, really didn't.
It's exactly 9 o'clock on Radio 1. There we go.
The keys.
Yes, you can plug them into the transmitter and get through to the 9 to 12 cupboard.
They don't fit, these ones.
And they?
No, you got the wrong ones, though.
No, I'm sure they're the right ones, aren't they? Try the long one.
Ah, that's got it.
Well done.
Lovely.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Stand by, take six. The golden
hour. Well, I didn't like that very much, no. Because a younger guy than me, 5 years younger, and a very good-looking guy called Noel Edmonds turned up. And that was slightly annoying, because I didn't want to move off Breakfast Show, but it was a sensible thing to do. I'd done it for 5 years, and Noel was, you know, a good-looking guy. He was destined to do television, which he was more interested in, actually. I don't think I was actually particularly welcoming to him. I think that was a mistake. Quite a cold atmosphere with him, because I didn't want to leave the Breakfast Show very much, and it wasn't his decision. And good luck to him, you know, he did it. But he got his own back on the Noel's house party later, because I went on that. And if you remember, he used to go there and he'd open the door, ding-dong, he'd open the door and I'd deliver a line, then he'd slam the door in your face. And he slammed the door and he turned to the camera and said, "I've been wanting to do that for years." And in the green room afterwards, I said to him, "You really meant that, didn't you?" He said, "Yes, I did."
No, it's me, Tony Blackburn.
Yeah.
And from that moment on, we became great friends, and we still are. But I've always been very competitive, and still am, you know, still am to this day, you know. And I think it's quite important to be competitive. This is a tough profession to be in. And the miners were on strike. They used to go on strike every damn year, you know. You know, the cold weather comes, so they'd go on strike, and they'd hold everybody up to ransom, I thought. And I was doing a pantomime, and the lights kept going out, and it really annoyed me. You've got a friend. I suggested on air that they might like to go back to work. And that didn't go down too well at the BBC, and quite rightfully so. So I was taken off the air by Douglas Muggeridge. He said, I've got to take you off the air, it's one of those things. We're your friends here on Radio 1. So the thing to do is to go away on holiday. And I tried to go away and I couldn't, everything was booked up. I was living in Cookham at the time, and there was a knock on the door and a load of reporters there. Radio 1. And I tried to make out I'd got a sore throat, because they hadn't been told. And I said, oh, yeah, sorry, I've got a sore throat and this sort of thing. And then they came out the following day, and I rang up the BBC and I said, look, I've got all these reporters here. Douglas said, oh, for God's sake, come back then. But I used to, I mean, now and then, you know, I used to get in trouble. I was too open with reporters and things like that. But now I know how to handle them. You know, you're coming from an era where, in the days when if you wanted to wish the Her Majesty the Queen a happy birthday, you had to get permission from the Queen and things like that. So the whole thing's changed. And I remember playing a record, Paul Anka, You're Having My Baby. And I got this phone call from Derek Chinnery, and you can't play a record like that. It's a record about having a baby. And I remember saying to him, well, people do have babies, Derek. And I don't really, it's a lovely record. Having my baby. You know, any punk record. I never played it. I just completely ignored it, and I hated everything about it, and I still do. I mean, soul music has always been my thing. Motown and Philadelphia, any black music. I did the first soul programme in this country on Radio London because I loved it, and they gave me a two-hour slot on a Sunday morning, very early on a Sunday morning, and I just loved soul music. I always have done. My dad loved soul music, Jackie Wilson particularly. And it's just the music I absolutely adore. And I was amazed when I came to the BBC how little of it they played. And in fact, if you look at the charts, really Motown wasn't successful until about 1964, 65, when we started playing it, and particularly on nationally, when I started introducing it into my breakfast show, because I made sure that, you know, we played a lot of Diana Ross and a lot of Marvin Gaye and things like that. And it's amazing to see in the charts, suddenly they start appearing in the charts, because it's just it's beautiful music.
Hello, Keith, how are you?
Oh, very well. How's the show going today?
Oh, marvellous. Just playing Captain Beaky.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I was moved on to doing the children's show, you know, it was from Ed Stewpot Stewart, who'd been doing Junior Choice for a long time. They wanted to move him off it, and it was called the Tony Blackburn Show. I was doing a kid's show with Maggie Philbin and Keith Chegwin, which was, I found, very difficult because they were doing a television show. When we did outside broadcasts, you know, they weren't interested in me because Keith and Maggie, they're much younger than me anyway, and I was doing this kid show on Radio 1, and I didn't really enjoy doing that show. You know, Puff the Magic Dragon isn't really for me. I don't think people realised in those days when I was on Radio 1, I was telling the silly jokes and things like that, and I don't think people realised how much I loved music. And I think it's only been recently, probably in the last 10, 15 years, that people do actually know that I actually do love music. Because a lot of the DJs, not that, some of them weren't interested in those days. You know, some of them used it just to get to television. But I always had a deep, deep love of music, always have. Radio 1. I was actually working 7 days a week. I was doing Radio 1 at the weekends. And during the week, I was on Radio London, the BBC Radio London, where I am still now, doing a very raunchy show. It was a soul show that I was doing. I suddenly became a shock jock, and I was chatting people up over the air, and because I was encouraged to by a guy called Derek Amore, one of the funniest people I've known. He I don't know what happened exactly. He came from television to Radio London, and he was a complete rebel. I was doing a show in the afternoon, an awful show on Radio London. It was really dreadful. It was a typical local radio program where we were swapping, you know, swap this for that and all that stuff. And I'd listened to some of the pirate stations in London, Kiss particularly, who was playing soul music, and I thought it was great. And I really wanted to do a soul programme. So Derek Amore took me out to have a meal. I'd been at Radio London for a little while. He said, I want you to do a show called the BBC, Blackburn Barnes and Company. It was Susie Barnes, a very nice lady, but I didn't really want to do a show with somebody else. So we were out for the evening, and we'd had a couple of glasses of wine, and Derek said, I want you to do the show called Blackburn Barnes and Company. I said to him, I said, I think that sounds awful. And he said, well, I want you to do it. I said, I'm going to have to resign. So he said, what, you're resigning? I said, well, I have to, because I said, I really can't do a show like that. He said, it sounds really awful. He said, what, you've resigned? I said, yes. He said, well, don't resign. So I said, all right, won't resign then. So he said, you've not resigned. So he said, all right, I'll sack you. So I said, well, you can't sack me, because I just resigned. And it went on like this for about an hour. And he said, I can't remember now if you sacked or resigned. He said, what the hell do you want to do? I said, well, I want to come on and do a soul programme. I want to play soul music. And I said, I want to do an outrageous programme just for a change. Do something different. And he said, all right, we'll start it on Monday morning. I said, well, I didn't anticipate it being in the morning. I thought it was a late night show. He said, no, I want to do it in the morning. And so I said, well, I want to make it a bit outrageous. I want to chat people up over the air and be stupid like that and start saying about I want to nibble your earlobes and gradually work my way down your inner thighs and all that nonsense. But I want to chat men and women up so I can't be called sexist. And he said, it sounds great. He was the controller of Radio London. So I came on the air and did this show, and I thought I'd been really over the top. And he said, I thought you were going to be outrageous. He said, I want you to go further than that. He said, I really want you to chat people up. And he got to a state when I got so nervous about it, because I thought, I can't go any further. And I actually began to get the shakes, and I got so uptight, I had to see a specialist. I was a nervous wreck.
Lonnie Hill. No relation to uphill. And could it be love? You know, it might be love, because love has its ups and downs.
Radio London, where you're never more than one record away from a soul smash. But
I did this show for about 6 or 7 years and invented the Soul Night Out. But the problem was, I was this shock jock in the week, and I was Uncle Tony at the weekends, and it just didn't work for me, you know. So eventually, I didn't have my contract renewed at Radio 1. But I was quite happy, funnily enough, just being at Radio London, because I was doing a show that really did well. It got a fantastic audience. And I remember, you know, if every cab I got into, they said, God, you know, that person you chatted up this morning, this sort of thing. And they were listening. I wanted to bring soul music not to a little small audience, but a massive audience, because I never wanted to be serious about music. It's there to be enjoyed and have fun with it. And so then I found Steve Walsh in the clubs. I wanted to have this show called the Radio London Soul Night Out. I wanted to get the thing out and about, Radio London. I found this club, the National Club in Kilburn, and they said, do you really think it's a good idea to do that? I said, yeah. And the club held 2,500, and none of us knew if anybody would turn up, and 5,000 people turned up on the night, and Stevie Wonder out of the blue. And it was amazing, absolutely amazing. Radio London, I absolutely adored it there and adored doing that show. And then, of course, it changed to GLR, and the whole thing collapsed, and I went to Capital Gold.
Thank you, Kenny. What's wrong?
My first button and it went wrong.
I had no trouble. Right now, a cool day with sunny spells and
Capital Gold. It was fun to start off with. It was okay. I enjoyed it to start off with, but they started changing the format. The person that's still there now, Richard Parkey, he went to America and found this system whereby you only talk for 3 records in a row and a time check. And I think that's what destroyed commercial radio. I'm very lucky. I work for 4 stations. One of them is, I work for one commercial radio station, KMFM in Kent. And they still allow people to have a personality. But I think the way commercial radio has gone for me is very sad, because we bought commercial radio in as personality radio. I like personality radio. I'm not interested in hearing 3 records in a row and a time check. Bloody monkey can do that. That's not my sort of radio. I don't listen anymore to commercial radio, really. Apart, LBC I like very much. Richard is a one-off. He's a tough person to work for. I wouldn't want to work for him again. He's very successful at what he does, but I don't believe in his type of radio, although he's had a lot of success with it. Look, I've got all the music I want on an iPhone. You know, if I want to listen to a jukebox, then I'll listen to my iPhone. I tune into radio to hear somebody who's a great broadcaster. I listen to Steve Wright because I think he's a really good, what I call a proper disc jockey. And I listen to Ken Bruce and these sort of people. They've got personality. They're fun to listen to. on commercial radio, I don't know who any of them are anymore. I work for KMFM, and I listen to that sometimes because they're allowed to have a personality. And I'm a great admirer of Rob Wills, who runs it. He's great. But the rest of them, not interested. The way that they run commercial radio now, I think, is totally idiotic. But nevertheless, they get audiences. If people want background music like that, I mean, a lot of people say that they listen to, you know, some people listen to Magic Radio, Magic. But they're not listening to it. It's in the background. You know, I hear it, I get into a cab, and it's on. Sometimes it's on in the background, but they're not listening to it. It gets an audience. You know, it gets an audience. I can't understand why advertisers advertise on it, because I don't think that people are actually hearing the message. Even when I was on Pirate Radio, I always had an admiration for the BBC, and I still do. Like any big organisation, it's got its faults. Nevertheless, I wouldn't change it. And, you know, all this business about the licence fee, I suggested to somebody that they should, before it was agreed for the licence fee, they should turn the BBC off. You know, turn everything off. And I think the public would realise what it would be like without a BBC, and I think the BBC is a terrific organisation.
I'm pop-picking landlord Tony Blackburn back with today's pair of charts. We're going to go back to 1966, followed by some hits from 1974. And I'll tell you something, the music is terrific, as always.
I hadn't been on national radio for 30 years. I mean, a lot of people don't bother about me anyway. When I say I hadn't been on national radio for that length of time, I hadn't. You know, when I left Radio 1, I was at Radio London. You know, that's why I do still like doing local BBC radio, because to me it doesn't matter the fact that, well, nowadays you can hear any station anywhere in the world now, so it doesn't matter. But being on just in London, it didn't matter to me, because the show I was doing, I thought, was probably the best show I'd ever done. And it probably is still the best show I've ever done, that one. So it didn't bother me I wasn't on national radio. But then when I was offered the job at Radio 2, yeah, that was a big thrill, yeah, come to the biggest station.
The Everly Brothers there, and walk right back. A very good morning. How are you this morning? Welcome along. It's Saturday. It's gradually getting lighter.
You know, all of a sudden, Sounds of the Sixties became available, and I'd already signed up to do the Golden Hour, and the Golden Hour is on at 7 o'clock till 8 on Friday evening. I now do the two shows, you know, so which is great, because I love doing the Golden Hour, because that's something that's real disc jockeying and stuff like that. They said I could record Sound of the Sixties, because I come off the air at 8 o'clock, and I'm have to get up at 3:30 that morning and come in and do the show at 6. But I wanted to do it live, you know, because to me it's really important to do that show live. I didn't want to copy what Brian Matthew was doing. I wanted to make it my own and make it different. And we call it the all-new Sound of the 60s now, and it's doing really, really well, which I'm glad.
Lovely. Welcome along, everyone, to Top of the Pops. And as you can see, we've got loads and loads of students from the Slough.
I'd love to do something a little bit on television. I'd like to actually do a gadget programme on TV, actually, because I'm really into gadgets and I love get it or something like that, or a talk show. But I've always loved radio more than television, really. Everybody's, I think, in television thought that, you know, I just really enjoyed just doing radio. When I was younger, I don't think I was very good on television, so it wasn't for me. Noel Edmonds did it really well. He was good on radio and TV. I was more self-conscious on TV. Actually, when I look back on Top of the Pops, I wasn't as bad as I thought I was. But I'd like to do something on TV now, but I think that those days are gone now. I've had to turn down two or three reality shows recently. There was a thing called Carry On Barging, and I watched it. It was just basically four people on a barge. I don't know if you saw it, but Debbie McGee was on, and I know Debbie very well, and I was watching that, and we'd tuned in for a laugh, actually, and it was terrific. It was a great show. And I had to turn down The Real Marigold Hotel as well. One of the reasons was because I'm a bit worried about the food, because I'm a vegetarian, and I know one or two people have been to India and come back, and it's taken them about 3 months to recover. And my doctor, who's a friend of mine, she told me that she's still got a patient who hasn't recovered from it. And I found out, I was talking to somebody who did that show, and they said that every single person out there who was on it ended up in hospital while they were doing it. But it's a great show. I'd love secretly to do it, but I'm not sure. You have to be away for 4 weeks as well.
I've had a fire going now since I came back, 24 hours a day, and I sleep in the fireplace.
I was at Capital Gold then, and I was offered it. My agent rung up, Nick, who was still my agent, and rung up and said to me one day, "So, how would you like to be dropped in the middle of the Australian jungle and survive for a fortnight?" And I thought he was joking, and I said, "Oh, that sounds like fun." So he said, "Oh, great." And that was it. And about 3 weeks later, I got this phone call saying they want to see you at ITV. And I said, what for? He said, well, the thing I told you about being dropped in the middle of a jungle. Went to see them there, and they said to me, there was a researcher, said, you know, do you like outdoor life and, you know, camping and all that stuff? And I said, well, not particularly. I've never really done it. I said, I'm a vegetarian. And they explained to me what the show was. And they said, well, how would you survive in the jungle? I said, well, I don't know, really. And I said, I wouldn't kill anything because I don't believe in killing animals and things. I love animals. And she said, why are you here? I said, well, you wanted to see me. I said, I don't know, really. You know, I was 60 years old then. I said, it sounds like a great show. I'd like to be a part of it, but I said, I can't understand why you'd want me. And that was it. And about another couple of weeks later, Nick said, they want you to do the show. My wife tried to talk me out of it, and my mother did as well. They said they didn't think I'd be very good at it. Sometimes, you know, I'm not one of these people that loves parties and things, and a vast number of people. I'm quite a, you know, I like just my family and being at home and watching Coronation Street, and I don't go to show business parties. I'm not that sort of person. And I did used to find people quite irritating as well. But I went in there, and I found myself suddenly becoming like the Henry Kissinger of the jungle. It was weird. I was with a load of people who really didn't like one another very much. But I loved it in there. Loved it. It's much more difficult now. I think the things that they're asking people to do now is really, you know, very difficult. But, you know, I got bitten by a snake. But that's about it, really. But I loved it. And it changed me as a person. It made me much more, much easier with people. I think it made it much easier with people. And I used to sit talking to Nell McAndrew, which is a delight in itself, by a lovely river. And I loved the jungle, and it was just beautiful. I loved it. And I remember when I came out, a dear old man came over to me on, he was on a Zimmer frame, actually, and I was filling my car up. It was at Brent Cross, and came up, and he flung his arms around me and said, you've done so much for our age group. And I had tears in my eyes, and I thought, actually, he's a lot older than I am, but I know what you mean. It's really sweet, and, you know, I couldn't believe I won it.
Well done, Tony. You're the king of the jungle.
It's been wonderful.
Tony, there's a hot shower and a warm bed waiting for you just over that bridge. You're the king of the jungle. Get yourself out of there!
I think it's really important to keep up to date with technology, and I've always loved technology. My dad loved technology. And I had one of the first sat-navs in this country. I had it in the days when it was only mapped with inside the M25, you know, so when it got to Camberley, you were on your own. And I had the first one of the first satellite dishes as well. And I've always been loved technology. You know, I've got the new iPhone 10, which I love. And I think anybody who's older who doesn't embrace it is missing out. You know, I was one of the first people on Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that. I think it's really important as a broadcaster to keep in touch with that. And some of my fellow broadcasters haven't. They're not around so much anymore. I like the past, but I'm more interested in the future. You know, I'm 74 now, and I wish I was slightly younger, because I would love to be around when the driverless car comes in. It probably will, actually. It actually, probably for me, it will come in at the right time, because I'll be too bloody old to drive properly. But to be able to sit in the car and tell it where I want to go, and it drives me there. But I think technology, and the way it's developed over the last 10, 15 years is amazing. And if you go into your house and the things you say, you know, Alicia or whatever it is, what's the weather like tomorrow? And you're talking to machinery, and we take it all for granted. It upsets me, the fact that we've got all this wonderful technology, but we're still killing one another in wars. It's crazy. And a human being, if only we could get something that would change the human being and make human beings not so violent and nicer to one another.
You particularly to look upon the show as your own. If you've got anybody you want to say hello to before you go to work,
I think possibly what I should have done is to possibly, and I came very close to it when I left Classic Gold, I probably should have run a radio station myself. I'd quite like to run one. And one thing that has happened in this country, which was very stupid, was not to put a 60s, 70s and 80s radio station on FM. And the advertising world doesn't realise, and my son's in advertising, I always said to him earlier on, the advertisers don't realise that the people they're advertising to, and they all want to advertise to younger people, they're not the ones that have got the money. I think it should be great to cater for older people as well, because we've got enough radio stations where you can cater for young people, but there should be a station, a national station, that caters more for older people as well. I mean, Radio 2 does it, but I think that there is room for another station, a 60s, 70s and 80s station, and I could put it on the air tomorrow and it would do very well, and I'd bring back some of the bigger names who are floundering because they're not allowed to be personalities.
BBC London W1, OK? And ask
him... Oh, God, nobody's going to remember me. Well, I, somebody who probably, hopefully... you know, brought some really great music to the airwaves and had fun with it, and hopefully made a few people laugh. I'd like to be remembered for, with people like Kenny Everett, people like that, who was a part of the golden age of radio, where we actually bought down a monopoly, really gave this country more choice in radio. I think that's what I'd like to be remembered for, really, more than anything else. And, of course, opening Radio 1 up.